ordinary user interface and access the code itself. The computer asked for his name, and he replied Nedry. That name was authorized to access the code, so the computer allowed him into the system. Nedry asked to go to command level, the computer's highest level of control. The command level required extra security and asked Nedry for his name, access number, and password. Nedry, 040-hatchmark-xy-67-ampersand, MR Goodbytes. Those entries got Nedry into the command level. From there, he wanted security, and since he was authorized, the computer allowed him to go there. Once at the security level, Nedry tried three variations. Key check off, safety off, SL off. "He's trying to turn off the safety systems," Wu said. "He doesn't want anybody to see what he's about to do."
"Exactly," Arnold said. "And apparently he doesn't know it's no longer possible to turn the systems off except by manually flipping switches on the main board."
After three failed commands, the computer automatically began to worry about Nedry. But since he had gotten in with proper authorization, the computer would assume that Nedry was lost, trying to do something he couldn't accomplish from where he was. So the computer asked him again where he wanted to be, and Nedry said, "Security." And he was allowed to remain there. Finally, Wu said, "Here's the kicker." He pointed to the last of the commands Nedry had entered, white_rabbit.object.
"What the hell is that?" Arnold said. "White rabbit? Is that supposed to be his private joke?"
"It's marked as an object," Wu said. In computer terminology, an object was a block of code that could be moved around and used the way you might move a chair in a room. An object might be a set of commands to draw a picture, or to refresh the screen, or to perform a certain calculation.
"Let's see where it is in the code," Arnold said. "Maybe we can figure out what it does."
He went to the program utilities and typed, find white_rabbit.object. The computer flashed back, "Object not found in libraries."
"It doesn't exist," Arnold said.
"Then search the code listing," Wu said. Arnold typed, find_listings, white_rabbit.object. The screen scrolled rapidly, the lines of code blurring as they swept past. It continued this way for almost a minute, and then abruptly stopped.
"There it is," Wu said. "It's not an object, it's a command."
The screen showed an arrow pointing to a single line of code buried amidst innocuous lines of instructions. "Arrow on white_rabbit.object call link, parenthesis security perimeter, parenthesis set to off."
"Son of a bitch," Arnold said.
Wu shook his head.
"It isn't a bug in the code at all." "No," Arnold said, "it's a trap door. The fat bastard put in what looked like an object call, but it's actually a command that links the security and perimeter systems and then turns them off. Gives him complete access to every place in the park."
"Then we must be able to turn them back on," Wu said.
"Yeah, we must." Arnold frowned at the screen. "All we have to do is figure out the command."
"I'll run an execution trace on the link," he said. "We'll see where that gets us." Wu got up from his chair.
"Meanwhile," he said,
"meanwhile, that somebody went into the freezer about an hour ago. I think I better go count my embryos."
Ellie was in her room, about to change out of her wet clothes, when there was a knock on the door.
"Alan?" she said.
But when she opened the door, she saw Muldoon standing there, with a plastic-wrapped package under his arm. Muldoon was also soaking wet, and there were streaks of dirt on his clothes.
"I'm sorry, but we need your help," Muldoon said briskly. "The land cruisers were attacked an hour ago. We brought Malcolm back, but he's in shock. He's got a very bad injury to his leg. He's still unconscious, but I put him in the bed in his room. Harding is on his way over."
"Harding?" she said. "What about the others?"
"We haven't found the others yet, Dr. Sattler," Muldoon said. He was speaking slowly now.
"Oh, my God."
"But we think that Dr. Grant and the children are still alive. We think they went into the park, Dr. Sattler."
"Went into the park?"
"We think so. Meanwhile, Malcolm needs help. I've called Harding."
"Shouldn't you call a doctor?"
"There's no doctor on the island. Harding's the best we have."
"But surely you can call for a doctor," she said.
"No," Muldoon shook his head. "Phone lines are down. We can't call out."
He shifted the package in his arm. "What's that?" she said.
"Nothing. Just go to Malcolm's room and help Harding, if you will."
And Muldoon was gone. She sat on her bed, shocked. Ellie Sattler was not a woman disposed to unnecessary panic, and she had known Grant to get out of dangerous situations before. Once he'd been lost in the Badlands for 4 days, when a cliff gave way beneath him, and his truck fell 100 feet into a ravine. Grant's right leg was broken. He had no water, but he had walked back on a broken leg. On the other hand, the kids... She shook her head, pushing the thought away. The kids were probably with Grant. And if Grant was out in the park, well, what better person to get them safely through Jurassic Park than a dinosaur expert? In the park.
"I'm tired," Lex said. "Carry me, Dr. Grant."
"You're too big to carry," Tim said.
"But I'm tired," she said.
"Okay, Lex," Grant said, picking her up. "Oof, you're heavy."
It was almost 9 p.m. The full moon was blurred by drifting mist, and their blunted shadows led them across an open field toward dark woods beyond. Grant was lost in thought, trying to decide where he was. Since they had originally crossed over the fence that the Tyrannosaur had battered down, Grant was reasonably sure they were now somewhere in the Tyrannosaur paddock, which was a place he did not want to be. In his mind, he kept seeing the computer tracing of the Tyrannosaur's home range, the tight squiggle of lines that traced his movements within a small area. He and the kids were in that area now. But Grant also remembered that the Tyrannosaurs were isolated from all the other animals, which meant that they would know they had left the paddock when they crossed a barrier, a fence, or a moat, or both. He had seen no barriers so far. The girl put her head on his shoulder and twirled her hair in her fingers. Soon she was snoring. Tim trudged alongside Grant.
"Are you holding up, Tim?"
"Okay," he said, "but I think we might be in the Tyrannosaur area."
"I'm pretty sure we are. I hope we get out soon."
"You going to go into the woods?" Tim said. As they came closer, the woods seemed dark and forbidding.
"Yes," Grant said, "I think we can navigate by the numbers on the motion sensors."
The motion sensors were green boxes set about 4 feet off the ground. Some were freestanding, most were attached to trees. None of them were working because apparently the power was still off. Each sensor box had a glass lens mounted in the center and a painted code number beneath that. Up ahead, in the mist-streaked moonlight, Grant could see a box marked T-S-04. They entered the forest. Huge trees loomed on all sides. In the moonlight, a low mist clung to the ground, curling around the roots of the trees. It was beautiful, but it made walking treacherous. And Grant was watching the sensors. They seemed to be numbered in descending order. He passed T-S-03 and T-S-02. Eventually, they reached T-S-01. He was tired from carrying the girl, and he had hoped this would coincide with a boundary for the Tyrannosaur paddock, but it was just another box in the middle of the woods. The next box after that was marked T-N-01, followed by T-N-02. Grant realized the numbers must be arranged geographically around a central point like a compass. They were going from south to north, so the numbers got smaller as they approached the center, then got larger again.
"At least we're going the right way," Tim said.
"Good for you," Grant said. Tim smiled and stumbled over vines in the mist. He got quickly to his feet. They walked on for a while.
"My parents are getting a divorce," he said.
"Uh-huh," Grant said.
"My dad moved out last month. He has his own place in Mill Valley now."
"Uh-huh."
"He never carries my sister anymore. He never even picks her up."
"And he says you have dinosaurs on the brain," Grant said. Tim sighed.
"Yeah."
"You miss him?" Grant said.
"Not really," Tim said. "Sometimes. She misses him more."
"Who, your mother?"
"No, Lex. My mom has a boyfriend. She knows him from work."
They walked in silence for a while, passing T-N-03 and T-N-04.
"Have you met him?" Grant said.
"Yeah."
"How is he?"
"He's okay," Tim said. "He's younger than my dad, but he's bald."
"How does he treat you?"
"I don't know. Okay. I think he just tries to get on my good side. I don't know what's going to happen. Sometimes my mom says we'll have to sell the house and move. Sometimes he and my mom fight, late at night. I sit in my room and play with my computer, but I can still hear it.
Uh-huh, Grant said.
Are you divorced?
No, Grant said. My wife died a long time ago.
And now you're with Dr. Sattler?
Grant smiled in the darkness. No, she's my student.
You mean she's still in school?
Graduate school, yes. Grant paused long enough to shift Lex to his other shoulder, and then they continued on, past T-stroke N-stroke 05 and T-stroke N-stroke 06. There was the rumble of thunder in the distance. The storm had moved to the south. There was very little sound in the forest except for the drone of cicadas and the soft croaking of tree frogs.
You have children? Tim asked.
No, Grant said.
Are you going to marry Dr. Sattler?
No, she's marrying a nice doctor in Chicago sometime next year.
Oh,
Tim said. He seemed surprised to hear it. They walked along for a while.
Then who are you going to marry?
I don't think I'm going to marry anybody, Grant said.
Me neither, Tim said.
They walked for a while. Tim said,
Are we going to walk all night?
I don't think I can, Grant said. We'll have to stop, at least for a few hours. He glanced at his watch. We're okay. We've got almost 15 hours before we have to be back, before the ship reaches the mainland.
Where are we going to stop? Tim asked immediately.
Grant was wondering the same thing. His first thought was that they might climb a tree and sleep up there. But they would have to climb very high to get safely away from the animals, and Lex might fall out while she was asleep. And tree branches were hard. They wouldn't get any rest. At least he wouldn't. They needed someplace really safe. He thought back to the plans he had seen on the jet coming down. He remembered that there were outlying buildings for each of the different divisions. Grant didn't know what they were like because plans for the individual buildings weren't included, and he couldn't remember exactly where they were. But he remembered they were scattered all around the park. There might be buildings somewhere nearby. But that was a different requirement from simply crossing a barrier and getting out of the Tyrannosaur paddock. Finding a building meant a search strategy of some kind, and the best strategies were... Tim, can you hold your sister for me? I'm going to climb a tree and have a look around. High in the branches, he had a good view of the forest, the tops of the trees extending away to his left and right. They were surprisingly near the edge of the forest. Directly ahead, the trees ended before a clearing with an electrified fence and a pale concrete moat. Beyond that, a large open field, in what he assumed was the sauropod paddock. In the distance, more trees and misty moonlight sparkling on the ocean. Somewhere he heard the bellowing of a dinosaur, but it was far away. He put on Tim's night vision goggles and looked again. He followed the gray curve of the moat, and then saw what he was looking for, the dark strip of a service road leading to the flat rectangle of a roof. The roof was barely above ground level, but it was there, and it wasn't far, maybe a quarter of a mile or so from the tree. When he came back down, Lex was sniffling.
What's the matter?
I heard an animal.
It won't bother us. Are you awake now? Come on.
He led her to the fence. It was 12 feet high, with a spiral of barbed wire at the top. It seemed to stretch far above them in the moonlight. The moat was immediately on the other side. Lex looked up at the fence doubtfully.
Can you climb it? Grant asked her.
She handed him her glove and her baseball.
Sure. Easy.
He started to climb.
But I bet Timmy can't.
Tim spun in fury. You shut up!
Timmy's afraid of heights.
I am not. She climbed higher.
I so am not. Then come and get me.
Grant turned to Tim, pale in the darkness. The boy wasn't moving. You okay with the fence, Tim?
Sure.
Want some help?
Timmy's a fraidy cat,
Lex called.
What a stupid jerk,
Tim said, and he started to climb.
It's freezing, Lex said.
They were standing waist-deep in smelly water at the bottom of a deep concrete moat. They had climbed the fence without incident, except that Tim had torn his shirt on the coils of barbed wire at the top. Then they had all slid down into the moat, and now Grant was looking for a way out.
At least I got Timmy over the fence for you, Lex said. He really is scared most times.
Thanks for your help, Tim said sarcastically.
In the moonlight, he could see floating lumps on the surface. He moved along the moat, looking at the concrete wall on the far side. The concrete was smooth. They couldn't possibly climb it.
Ew,
Lex said, pointing to the water. It won't hurt you, Lex. Grant finally found a place where the concrete had cracked and a vine grew down toward the water. He tugged on the vine, and it held his weight.
Let's go, kids.
They started to climb the vine back to the field above. It took only a few minutes to cross the field to the embankment leading to the below-grade service road and the maintenance building off to the right. They passed two motion sensors, and Grant noticed with some uneasiness that the sensors were still not working, nor were the lights. More than 2 hours had passed since the power first went out, and it was not yet restored. Somewhere in the distance they heard the Tyrannosaur roar.
Is he around here?
Lex said. No, Grant said. We're in another section of park from him. They slid down a grassy embankment and moved toward the concrete building. In the darkness, it was forbidding, bunker-like.
What is this place?
Lex said. It's safe, Grant said, hoping that was true. The entrance gate was large enough to drive a truck through. It was fitted with heavy bars. Inside, they could see the building was an open shed with piles of grass and bales of hay stacked among equipment. The gate was locked with a heavy padlock. As Grant was examining it, Lex slipped sideways between the bars.
Come on, you guys.
Tim followed her.
I think you can do it, Dr. Grant.
He was right. It was a tight squeeze, but Grant was able to ease his body between the bars and get into the shed. As soon as he was inside, a wave of exhaustion struck him.
I wonder if there's anything to eat,
Lex said. Just hay. Grant broke open a bale and spread it around on the concrete. The hay in the center was warm. They lay down, feeling the warmth. Lex curled up beside him and closed her eyes. Tim put his arm around her. He heard the sauropods trumpeting softly in the distance. Neither child spoke. They were almost immediately snoring. Grant raised his arm to look at his watch, but it was too dark to see. He felt the warmth of the children against his own body. Grant closed his eyes and slept. Control. Muldoon and Gennaro came into the control room just as Arnold clapped his hands and said, "Got you, you little son of a bitch!" "What is it?" Gennaro said. Arnold pointed to the screen where arrows pointed to four more lines of code. Arrow on Feeny.object link set security perimeter. Arrow on Feeny.object call link.sst security perimeter set to on. Arrow on Feeny.object set link.sst security perimeter restore. Arrow on Feeny.object delete line rf white underscore rabbit.object Feeny.object.
That's it, Arnold said, pleased.
That's what?
Gennaro asked, staring at the screen.
I finally found the command to restore the original code. The command called Feeny.object resets the linked parameters, namely the fence and the power.
Good, Muldoon said.
But it does something else, Arnold said. It then erases the code lines that refer to it. It destroys all evidence it was ever there.
Pretty slick. Gennaro shook his head.
I don't know much about computers. Although he knew enough to know what it meant when a high-tech company went back to the source code, it meant big, big problems.
Well, watch this, Arnold said, and he typed in the command Feeny.object. The screen flickered and immediately changed. Muldoon pointed to the windows.
Look!
Outside, the big quartz lights were coming on throughout the park. They went to the windows and looked out.
Hot damn, Arnold said.
Gennaro said, does this mean the electrified fences are back on?
You bet it does, Arnold said. It'll take a few seconds to get up to full power because we've got 50 miles of fence out there and the generator has to charge the capacitors along the way. But in half a minute, we'll be back in business.
Arnold pointed to the vertical glass see-through map of the park. On the map, bright red lines were snaking out from the power station, moving throughout the park as electricity surged through the fences.
And the motion sensors? Gennaro said.
Yes, them too. It'll be a few minutes while the computer counts.
But everything's working, Arnold said. 9:30, and we've got the whole damn thing back up and running.
Grant opened his eyes. Brilliant blue light was streaming into the building through the bars of the gate. Quartz light. The power was back on. Groggily, he looked at his watch. It was just 9:30. He'd been asleep only a couple of minutes. He decided he could sleep a few minutes more, and then he would go back up to the field and stand in front of the motion sensors and wave, setting them off. The control room would spot him. They'd send a car out to pick him and the kids up. He'd tell Arnold to recall the supply ship, and they'd all finish the night in their own beds back in the lodge. He would do that right away. In just a couple of minutes, he yawned and closed his eyes again. Not bad, Arnold said in the control room, staring at the glowing map. There's only 3 cutouts in the whole park. Much better than I hoped for. Cutouts? Gennaro said. The fence automatically cuts out short-circuited sections, he explained. You can see a big one here in Sector 12, near the main road. That's where the wrecks knocked the fence down, Muldoon said. Exactly. And another one is here in Sector 11, near the sauropod maintenance building. Why would that section be out? Gennaro said. God knows, Arnold said. Probably storm damage, or a fallen tree. We can check it on the monitor in a while. The third one is over there by the jungle river. Don't know why that should be out either. As Gennaro looked, the map became more complex, filling with green spots and numbers. What's all this? The animals. The motion sensors are working again, and the computer's starting to identify the location of all the animals in the park, and anybody else, too. Gennaro stared at the map. You mean Grant and the kids? Yes. We've reset our search number above 400. So if they're out there moving around, Arnold said, the motion sensors will pick them up as additional animals. He stared at the map. But I don't see any additionals yet. Why does it take so long? Gennaro said. You have to realize, Mr. Gennaro, Arnold said, that there's a lot of extraneous movement out there. Branches blowing in the wind, birds flying around, all kinds of stuff. The computer has to eliminate all the background movement. It may take, Okay, count's finished. Gennaro said, you don't see the kids? Arnold twisted in his chair and looked back to the map. No, he said. At the moment, there are no additionals on the map at all. Everything out there has been accounted for as a dinosaur. They're probably up in a tree, or somewhere else where we can't see them. I wouldn't worry yet. Several animals haven't shown up, like the big Rex. That's probably because it's sleeping somewhere and not moving. The people may be sleeping, too. We just don't know. Muldoon shook his head. We better get on with it, he said. We need to repair the fences and get the animals back into their paddocks. According to that computer, we got 5 to herd back to the proper paddocks. I'll take the maintenance crews out now. Arnold turned to Gennaro. You may want to see how Dr. Malcolm is doing. Tell Dr. Harding that Muldoon will need him in about an hour to supervise the herding, and I'll notify Mr. Hammond that we're starting our final cleanup. Gennaro passed through the iron gates and went in the front door of the safari lodge. He saw Ellie Sattler coming down the hallway carrying towels and a pan of steaming water. There's a kitchen at the other end, she said. We're using that to boil water for the dressings. How is he? Gennaro asked. Surprisingly good, she said. Gennaro followed Ellie down to Malcolm's room and was startled to hear the sound of laughter. The mathematician lay on his back in the bed with Harding adjusting an IV line. So the other man says, I'll tell you frankly, I didn't like it, Bill. I went back to toilet paper. Harding was laughing. It's not bad, is it? Malcolm said, smiling. Ah, Mr. Gennaro, you've come to see me. Now you know what happens from trying to get a leg up on the situation. Gennaro came in tentatively. Harding said, he's on fairly high doses of morphine. Not high enough, I can tell you, Malcolm said. Christ, he's stingy with his drugs. Did they find the others yet? No, not yet, Gennaro said, but I'm glad to see you doing so well. How else should I be doing, Malcolm said, with a compound fracture of the leg that is likely septic and beginning to smell rather, pungent? But I always say if you can't keep a sense of humor, Gennaro smiled. Do you remember what happened? Of course I remember, Malcolm said. Do you think you could be bitten by a Tyrannosaurus Rex and it would escape your mind? No, indeed, I'll tell you, you remember it for the rest of your life. In my case, perhaps not a terribly long time, but still, yes, I remember. Malcolm described running from the land cruiser in the rain and being chased down by the wrecks.
It was my own damn fault. He was too close, but I was panicked. In any case, he picked me up in his jaws.
How? Gennaro said.
Torso, Malcolm said and lifted his shirt. A broad semicircle of bruised punctures ran from his shoulder to his navel. Lifted me up in his jaws, shook me bloody hard, and threw me down. And I was fine. Terrified, of course, but still and all fine. Right up to the moment he threw me. I broke the leg in the fall, but the bite was not half bad.
He sighed, considering. Harding said, most of the big carnivores don't have strong jaws. The real power is in the neck musculature. The jaws just hold on while they use the neck to twist and rip. But with a small creature like Dr. Malcolm, the animal would just shake him and then toss him.
I'm afraid that's right, Malcolm said. I doubt I'd have survived except the big chap's heart wasn't in it. To tell the truth, he struck me as a rather clumsy attacker of anything less than an automobile or a small apartment building.
You think he attacked half-heartedly?
It pains me to say it, Malcolm said, but I don't honestly feel I had his full attention. He had mine, of course, but then he weighs 8 tons. I don't.
Gennaro turned to Harding and said, they're going to repair the fences now. Arnold says Muldoon will need your help herding animals.
Okay, Harding said. So long as you leave me Dr. Sattler and ample morphine, Malcolm said, and so long as we do not have a Malcolm effect here.
What's a Malcolm effect, Gennaro said.
Modesty forbids me, Malcolm said, from telling you the details of a phenomenon named after me.
He sighed again and closed his eyes. In a moment he was sleeping. Ellie walked out into the hallway with Gennaro.
Don't be fooled, she said. It's a great strain on him. When will you have a helicopter here?
A helicopter?
He needs surgery on that leg. Make sure they send for a helicopter and get him off this island.
The park. The portable generators sputtered and roared to life, and the quartz floodlights glowed at the ends of their telescoping arms. Muldoon heard the soft gurgle of the jungle river a few yards to the north. He turned back to the maintenance van and saw one of the workmen coming out with a big power saw.
No, no, he said, just the ropes, Carlos. We don't need to cut it.
They turned back to look at the fence. They had difficulty finding the shortened section at first because there wasn't much to see. A small protocarpus tree was leaning against the fence. It was one of several that had been planted in this region of the park, their feathery branches intended to conceal the fence from view. But this particular tree had been tied down with guy wires and turnbuckles. The wires had broken free in the storm, and the metal turnbuckles had blown against the fence and shorted it out. Of course, none of this should have happened. Grounds crews were supposed to use plastic-coated wires and ceramic turnbuckles near fences, but it had happened anyway. In any case, it wasn't going to be a big job. All they had to do was pull the tree off the fence, remove the metal fittings, and mark it for the gardeners to fix in the morning. It shouldn't take more than 20 minutes. And that was just as well, because Muldoon knew the Dilophosaurs always stayed close to the river. Even though the workmen were separated from the river by the fence, the Dillos could spit right through it, delivering their blinding poison. Ramon, one of the workmen, came over.
Señor Muldoon, he said, did you see the lights?
What lights? Muldoon said.
Ramon pointed to the east through the jungle.
I saw it as we were coming out. It is there, very faint. You see it? It looks like the lights of a car, but it is not moving.
Muldoon squinted. It probably was just a maintenance light. After all, power was back on.
We'll worry about it later, he said. Right now, let's just get that tree off the fence.
Arnold was in an expansive mood. The park was almost back in order. Muldoon was repairing the fences. Hammond had gone off to supervise the transfer of the animals with Harding. Although he was tired, Arnold was feeling good. He was even in a mood to indulge the lawyer, Gennaro.
The Malcolm effect? Arnold said. You worried about that?
I'm just curious, Gennaro said.
You mean you want me to tell you why Ian Malcolm is wrong?
Sure.
Arnold lit another cigarette.
It's technical.
Try me.
Okay, Arnold said. Chaos theory describes non-linear systems.
It's now become a very broad theory that's been used to study everything from the stock market to heart rhythms. A very fashionable theory. Very trendy to apply it to any complex system where there might be unpredictability. Okay?
Okay, Gennaro said.
Ian Malcolm is a mathematician specializing in chaos theory. Quite amusing and personable, but basically what he does, besides wear black, is use computers to model the behavior of complex systems. And John Hammond loves the latest scientific fad, so he asked Malcolm to model the system at Jurassic Park, which Malcolm did. Malcolm's models are all face space shapes on a computer screen. Have you seen them?
No,
Gennaro said. Well, they look like a weird, twisted ship's propeller. According to Malcolm, the behavior of any system follows the surface of the propeller. You with me?
Not exactly, Gennaro said.
Arnold held his hand in the air. Let's say I put a drop of water on the back of my hand. That drop is going to run off my hand. Maybe it'll run toward my wrist. Maybe it'll run toward my thumb. Or down between my fingers. I don't know for sure where it will go, but I know it will run somewhere along the surface of my hand. It has to.
Okay, Gennaro said.
Chaos theory treats the behavior of a whole system like a drop of water moving on a complicated propeller surface. The drop may spiral down or slip outward toward the edge. It may do many different things, depending. But it will always move along the surface of the propeller.
Okay.
Malcolm's models tend to have a ledge or a sharp incline where the drop of water will speed up greatly. He modestly calls this speeding up movement the Malcolm effect. The whole system could suddenly collapse. And that was what he said about Jurassic Park, that it had inherent instability.
Inherent instability, Gennaro said.
And what did you do when you got his report?
We disagreed with it and ignored it, of course, Arnold said.
Was that wise?
It's self-evident, Arnold said. We're dealing with living systems, after all. This is life, not computer models.
In the harsh quartz lights, the hypsilophodont's green head hung down out of the sling, the tongue dangling, the eyes dull.
Careful! Careful!
Hammond shouted as the crane began to lift. Harding grunted and eased the head back onto the leather straps. He didn't want to impede circulation through the carotid artery. The crane hissed as it lifted the animal into the air onto the waiting flatbed truck. The Hypsy was a small dryosaur, 7 feet long, weighing about 500 pounds. She was dark green, with mottled brown spots. She was breathing slowly, but she seemed all right. Harding had shot her a few minutes before with a tranquilizer gun, and apparently he had guessed the correct dose. There was always a tense moment dosing these big animals. Too little and they would run off into the forest, collapsing where you couldn't get to them. Too much and they went into terminal cardiac arrest. This one had taken a single bounding leap and keeled over, perfectly dosed.
Watch it! Easy!
Hammond was shouting to the workman.
Mr. Hammond, Harding said, please.
Well, they should be careful.
They are being careful, Harding said.
He climbed up onto the back of the flatbed as the Hypsy came down, and he set her into the restraining harness. Harding slipped on the cardiogram collar that monitored heartbeat, then picked up the big electronic thermometer the size of a turkey baster, and slipped it into the rectum. It beeped. 96.2 degrees.
How is she?
Hammond asked fretfully.
She's fine, Harding said. She's only dropped a degree and a half.
That's too much, Hammond said. Too deep.
You don't want her waking up and jumping off the truck, Harding snapped.
Before coming to the park, Harding had been the chief of veterinary medicine at the San Diego Zoo and the world's leading expert on avian care. He flew all over the world, consulting with zoos in Europe, India, and Japan on the care of exotic birds. He'd had no interest when this peculiar little man showed up, offering him a position in a private game park. But when he learned what Hammond had done, it was impossible to pass up. Harding had an academic bent, and the prospect of writing the first textbook of veterinary internal medicine, Diseases of Dinosauria, was compelling. In the late 20th century, veterinary medicine was scientifically advanced. The best zoos ran clinics little different from hospitals. New textbooks were merely refinements of old. For a world-class practitioner, there were no worlds left to conquer. But to be the first to care for a whole new class of animals, that was something. And Harding had never regretted his decision. He had developed considerable expertise with these animals, and he didn't want to hear from Hammond now. The Hipsy snorted and twitched. She was still breathing shallowly. There was no ocular reflex yet, but it was time to get moving.
"All aboard," Harding shouted. "Let's get this girl back to her paddock."
"Living systems," Arnold said, "are not like mechanical systems. Living systems are never in equilibrium. They are inherently unstable. They may seem stable, but they're not. Everything is moving and changing. In a sense, everything is on the edge of collapse."
Dinara was frowning. "But lots of things don't change. Body temperature doesn't change, all kinds of other..."
"Body temperature changes constantly," Arnold said. "Constantly. It changes cyclically over 24 hours, lowest in the morning, highest in the afternoon. It changes with mood, with disease, with exercise, with outside temperature, with food. It continuously fluctuates up and down, tiny jiggles on a graph, because at any moment some forces are pushing temperature up or other forces are pulling it down. It is inherently unstable, and every other aspect of living systems is like that, too."
"So you're saying Malcolm's just another theoretician," Arnold said. "Sitting in his office, he made a nice mathematical model, and it never occurred to him that what he saw as defects were actually necessities. Look, when I was working on missiles, we dealt with something called resonant yaw. Resonant yaw meant that even though a missile was only slightly unstable off the pad, it was hopeless. It was inevitably going to go out of control, and it couldn't be brought back. That's a feature of mechanical systems. A little wobble can get worse until the whole system collapses. But those same little wobbles are essential to a living system. They mean the system is healthy and responsive. Malcolm never understood that."
"Are you sure he didn't understand that? He seems pretty clear on the difference between living and non-living."
"Look," Arnold said, "the proof is right here."
He pointed to the screens.
"In less than an hour," he said, "the park will be all back online. The only thing I've got left to clear is the telephones. For some reason, they're still out, but everything else will be working. And that's not theoretical, that's a fact."
The needle went deep into the neck, and Harding injected the Medrine into the anesthetized female dryosaur as she lay on her side on the ground. Immediately, the animal began to recover, snorting and kicking her powerful hind legs.
"Back, everybody," Harding said, scrambling away. "Get back."
The dinosaur staggered to her feet, standing drunkenly. She shook her lizard head, stared at the people standing back in the quartz lights, and blinked.
"She's drooling," Hammond said, worried.
"Temporary," Harding said. "It'll stop." The dryosaur coughed, and then moved slowly across the field, away from the lights.
"Why isn't she huffing?"
"She will," Harding said. "It'll take her about an hour to recover fully. She's fine." He turned back to the car.
"Okay, boys, let's go deal with a stego."
Muldoon watched as the last of the stakes was pounded into the ground. The lines were pulled taut, and the protocarpus tree was lifted clear. Muldoon could see the blackened, charred streaks on the silver fence where the short had occurred. At the base of the fence, several ceramic insulators had burst. They would have to be replaced. But before that could be done, Arnold would have to shut down all the fences.
"Control, this is Muldoon. We're ready to begin repair."
"All right," Arnold said. "Shutting out your section now."
Muldoon glanced at his watch. Somewhere in the distance he heard soft hooting. It sounded like owls, but he knew it was the Dilophosaurs. He went over to Ramon and said,
"Let's finish this up. I want to get to those other sections of fence."
An hour went by. Donald Gennaro stared at the glowing map in the control room as the spots and numbers flickered and changed.
"What's happening now?"
Arnold worked at the console.
"I'm trying to get the phones back so we can call about Malcolm."
"No, I mean out there."
Arnold glanced up at the board.
"It looks as if they're about done with the animals and the two sections. Just as I told you, the park is back in hand, with no catastrophic Malcolm effect. In fact, there's just that third section of fence." "Arnold!"
It was Muldoon's voice.
"Yes? Have you seen this bloody fence?"
"Just a minute." On one of the monitors, Gennaro saw a high angle down in a field of grass blowing in the wind. In the distance was a low concrete roof. That's the sauropod maintenance building, Arnold explained. It's one of the utility structures we use for equipment, feed storage, and so on. We have them all around the park, in each of the paddocks. On the monitor, the video image panned. We're turning the camera now to get a look at the fence. Gennaro saw a shining wall of metallic mesh in the light. One section had been trampled, knocked flat. Muldoon's jeep and work crew were there.
Huh, Arnold said. Looks like the wrecks went into the sauropod paddock.
Muldoon said,
fine dining tonight.
We'll have to get him out of there, Arnold said.
With what? Muldoon said. We haven't got anything to use on a Rex. I'll fix this fence, but I'm not going in there until daylight.
Hammond won't like it.
We'll discuss it when I get back, Muldoon said.
How many sauropods will the Rex kill? Hammond said, pacing around the control room.
Probably just one, Harding said. Sauropods are big. The Rex can feed off a single kill for several days.
We have to go out and get him tonight, Hammond said.
Muldoon shook his head. I'm not going in there until daylight. Hammond was rising up and down on the balls of his feet, the way he did whenever he was angry.
Are you forgetting you work for me?
No, Mr. Hammond, I'm not forgetting. But that's a full-grown adult Tyrannosaur out there. How do you plan to get him?
We have tranquilizer guns.
We have tranquilizer guns that shoot a 20cc dart,
Muldoon said.
Fine for an animal that weighs 400 or 500 pounds. That Tyrannosaur weighs 8 tons. It wouldn't even feel it.
You ordered a larger weapon.
I ordered 3 larger weapons, Mr. Hammond, but you cut the requisition, so we only got one. And it's gone. Nedry took it when he left.
That was pretty stupid. Who let that happen?
Nedry's not my problem, Mr. Hammond,
Muldoon said.
You're saying, Hammond said, that as of this moment, there is no way to stop the Tyrannosaur?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Muldoon said.
That's ridiculous, Hammond said.
It's your park, Mr. Hammond. You didn't want anybody to be able to injure your precious dinosaurs.
Well, now you've got a Rex in with the sauropods, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it.
He left the room.
Just a minute, Hammond said, hurrying after him.
Gennaro stared at the screens and listened to the shouted argument in the hallway outside. He said to Arnold,
I guess you don't have control of the park yet, after all.
Don't kid yourself, Arnold said, lighting another cigarette.
We have the park. It'll be dawn in a couple of hours. We may lose a couple of dinos before we get the Rex out of there, but believe me, we have the park.
Dawn. Grant was awakened by a loud grinding noise, followed by a mechanical clanking. He opened his eyes and saw a bale of hay rolling past him on a conveyor belt up toward the ceiling. 2 more bales followed it. Then the clanking stopped as abruptly as it had begun, and the concrete building was silent again. Grant yawned. He stretched sleepily, winced in pain, and sat up. Soft yellow light came through the side windows. It was morning. He had slept the whole night. He looked quickly at his watch. 5 a.m. Still almost 6 hours to go before the boat had to be recalled. He rolled onto his back, groaning. His head throbbed and his body ached as if he had been beaten up. From around the corner he heard a squeaking sound like a rusty wheel, and then Lex giggling. Grant stood slowly and looked at the building. Now that it was daylight, he could see it was some kind of maintenance building with stacks of hay and supplies. On the wall he saw a gray metal box and a stenciled sign, Sauropod Maintenance Building 04. This must be the sauropod paddock, as he had thought. He opened the box and saw a telephone, but when he lifted the receiver he heard only hissing static. Apparently the phones weren't working yet.
Chew your food, Lex was saying. Don't be a piggy, Ralph.
Grant walked around the corner and found Lex by the bars, holding out handfuls of hay to an animal outside that looked like a large pink pig, and was making the squeaking sounds Grant had heard. It was actually an infant triceratops about the size of a pony. The infant didn't have horns on its head yet, just a curved bony frill behind big soft eyes. It poked its snout through the bars toward Lex, its eyes watching her as she fed it more hay.
That's better, Lex said. There's plenty of hay, don't worry.
He patted the baby on the head.
You like hay, don't you, Ralph?
Lex turned back and saw him.
Do This is Ralph, Lex said. He's my friend. He likes hay.
Brad took a step and stopped, wincing.
You look pretty bad, Lex said.
I feel pretty bad.
Tim, too. His nose is all swollen up.
Where is Tim?
Peeing, she said. You want to help me feed Ralph?
The baby Triceratops looked at Grant. Hay stuck out of both sides of its mouth, dropping on the floor as it chewed.
He's a very messy eater, Lex said, and he's very hungry.
The baby finished chewing and licked its lips. It opened its mouth, waiting for more. Grant could see the slender, sharp teeth and the beaky upper jaw like a parrot.
Okay, just a minute, Lex said, scooping up more straw from the concrete floor. Honestly, Ralph, she said, you'd think your mother never fed you.
Why is his name Ralph?
Because he looks like Ralph at school.
Grant came closer and touched the skin of the neck gently.
It's okay, you can pet him, Lex said. He likes it when you pet him, don't you, Ralph?
The skin felt dry and warm, with a pebbled texture of a football. Ralph gave a little squeak as Grant petted it. Outside the bars, its thick tail swung back and forth with pleasure.
He's pretty tame.
Ralph looked from Lex to Grant as it ate and showed no sign of fear. It reminded Grant that the dinosaurs didn't have ordinary responses to people.
Maybe I can ride him, Lex said.
Let's not.
I bet he'd let me, Lex said. It'd be fun to ride a dinosaur.
Grant looked out the bars past the animal to the open fields of the sauropod compound. It was growing lighter every minute. He should go outside, he thought, and set off one of the motion sensors on the field above. After all, it might take the people in the control room an hour to get out here to him, and he didn't like the idea that the phones were still down. He heard a deep snorting sound, like the snort of a very large horse, and suddenly the baby became agitated. It tried to pull its head back through the bars, but got caught on the edge of its frill, and it squeaked in fright. The snorting came again. It was closer this time. Ralph reared up on its hind legs, frantic to get out from between the bars. It wriggled its head back and forth, rubbing against the bars.
"Ralph, take it easy," Lex said.
"Push him out," Grant said. He reached up to Ralph's head and leaned against it, pushing the animal sideways and backward. The frill popped free, and the baby fell outside the bars, losing its balance and flopping on its side. Then the baby was covered in shadow, and a huge leg came into view, thicker than a tree trunk. The foot had five curved toenails like an elephant's. Ralph looked up and squeaked. A head came down into view, 6 feet long, with three long white horns, one above each of the large brown eyes, and a smaller horn at the tip of the nose. It was a full-grown Triceratops. The big animal peered at Lex and Grant, blinking slowly, and then turned its attention to Ralph. A tongue came out and licked the baby. Ralph squeaked and rubbed up against the big leg happily.
"Is that his mom?"
Lex said. "Looks like it," Grant said.
"Should we feed the mom, too?" Lex said.
But the big Triceratops was already nudging Ralph with her snout, pushing the baby away from the bars. "Guess not." The infant turned away from the bars and walked off. From time to time, the big mother nudged her baby, guiding it away as they both walked out into the fields.
"Goodbye, Ralph,"
Lex said, waving. Tim came out of the shadows of the building.
"Tell you what," Grant said, "I'm going up on the hill to set off the motion sensors so they'll know to come get us. You two stay here and wait for me."
"No,"
Lex said.
"Why? Stay here. It's safe here."
"You're not leaving us," she said. "Right, Timmy?"
"Right," Tim said. "Okay," Grant said. They crawled through the bars, stepping outside. It was just before dawn. The air was warm and humid, the sky soft pink and purple. A white mist clung low to the ground. Some distance away, they saw the mother Triceratops and the baby moving away toward a herd of large, duck-billed hadrosaurs, eating foliage from trees at the edge of the lagoon. Some of the hadrosaurs stood knee-deep in the water. They drank, lowering their flat heads, meeting their own reflections in the still water. Then they looked up again, their heads swiveling. At the water's edge, one of the babies ventured out, squeaked, and scrambled back while the adults watched indulgently. Farther south, other hadrosaurs were eating the lower vegetation. Sometimes they reared up on their hind legs, resting their forelegs on the tree trunks so they could reach the leaves on higher branches.
And in the far distance, a giant apatosaur stood above the trees, the tiny head swiveling on the long neck. The scene was so peaceful, Grant found it hard to imagine any danger.
"Yow!"
Lex shouted, ducking. Two giant red dragonflies with 6-foot wingspans hummed past them.
"What was that?"
"Dragonflies," he said. "The Jurassic was a time of huge insects."
"Do they bite?"
Lex said. "I don't think so," Grant said. Tim held out his hand. One of the dragonflies lighted on it. He could feel the weight of the huge insect.
"He's gonna bite you,"
Lex warned. But the dragonfly just slowly flapped its red-veined, transparent wings, and then, when Tim moved his arm, flew off again.
"Which way do we go?"
Lex said. "There." They started walking across the field. They reached a black box mounted on a heavy metal tripod, the first of the motion sensors. Grant stopped and waved his hand in front of it back and forth, but nothing happened. If the phones didn't work, perhaps the sensors didn't work either. "We'll try another one," he said, pointing across the field. Somewhere in the distance, they heard the roar of a large animal.
"Ah, hell," Arnold said. "I just can't find it."
He sipped coffee and stared, bleary-eyed, at the screens. He had taken all the video monitors offline. In the control room, he was searching the computer code. He was exhausted. He'd been working for 12 straight hours. He turned to Wu, who would come up from the lab.
"Find what?" "The phones are still out. I can't get them back on. I think Nedry did something to the phones."
Wu lifted one phone, heard hissing.
"Sounds like a modem." "But it's not," Arnold said, "because I went down into the basement and shut off all the modems. What you're hearing is just white noise that sounds like a modem transmitting."
"So the phone lines are jammed?"
"Basically, yes. Nedry jammed them very well. He's inserted some kind of a lockout into the program code, and now I can't find it, because I gave that restore command which erased part of the program listings. But apparently the command to shut off the phones is still resident in the computer memory."
Wu shrugged.
"So, just reset, shut the system down, and you'll clear memory." "I've never done it before," Arnold said, "and I'm reluctant to do it. Maybe all the systems will come back on startup, but maybe they won't. I'm not a computer expert, and neither are you. Not really. And without an open phone line, we can't talk to anybody who is."
"If the command is RAM resident, it won't show up in the code. You can do a RAM dump and search that, but you don't know what you're searching for. I think all you can do is reset."
Gennaro stormed in. "We still don't have any telephones. Working on it. You've been working on it since midnight, and Malcolm is worse. He needs medical attention."
"It means I'll have to shut down," Arnold said. "I can't be sure everything will come back on."
Gennaro said, "Look, there's a sick man over in that lodge. He needs a doctor or he'll die. You can't call for a doctor unless you have a phone. 4 people have probably died already. Now shut down and get the phones working."
Arnold hesitated.
"Well," Gennaro said, "well, it's just the safety systems don't allow the computer to be shut down, and..."
"Then turn the goddamn safety systems off! Can't you get it through your head that he's gonna die unless he gets help?"
"Okay," Arnold said. He got up and went to the main panel. He opened the doors and uncovered the metal swing latches over the safety switches. He popped them off, one after another. "You asked for it," Arnold said, "and you got it."
He threw the master switch. The control room was dark. All the monitors were black. The 3 men stood there in the dark.
"How long do we have to wait?" Gennaro said.
30 seconds,
Arnold said.
"P.U.,"
Lex said as they crossed the field.
"What?" Grant said.
"That smell," Lex said. "It stinks like rotten garbage."
Grant hesitated. He stared across the field toward the distant trees, looking for movement. He saw nothing. There was hardly a breeze to stir the branches. It was peaceful and silent in the early morning.
"I think it's your imagination," he said.
"Is not."
Then he heard the honking sound. It came from the herd of duck-billed hadrosaurs behind them, first one animal, then another and another, until the whole herd had taken up the honking cry. The duckbills were agitated, twisting and turning, hurrying out of the water, circling the young ones to protect them. "They smell it too," Grant thought. With a roar, the tyrannosaur burst from the trees 50 yards away near the lagoon.
It rushed out across the open field with huge strides. It ignored them, heading toward the herd of hadrosaurs.
I told you, Lex screamed. Nobody listens to me.
In the distance, the duckbills were honking and starting to run. Grant could feel the earth shake beneath his feet.
Come on, kids!
He grabbed Lex, lifting her bodily off the ground, and ran with Tim through the grass. He had glimpses of the tyrannosaur down by the lagoon, lunging at the hadrosaurs, which swung their big tails in defense and honked loudly and continuously. He heard the crashing of foliage and trees, and when he looked over again, the duckbills were charging. In the darkened control room, Arnold checked his watch. 30 seconds. The memory should be cleared by now. He pushed the main power switch back on. Nothing happened. Arnold's stomach heaved. He pushed the switch off, then on again. Still nothing happened. He felt sweat on his brow.
What's wrong? Gennaro said.
Oh, hell,
Arnold said. Then he remembered you had to turn the safety switches back on before you restarted the power. He flipped on the three safeties and covered them again with the latch covers. Then he held his breath and turned the main power switch. The room lights came on. The computer beeped. The screens hummed.
Thank God, Arnold said.
He hurried to the main monitor. Below the heading Jurassic Park System Startup, there were rows of labels on the screen. Gennaro reached for the phone, but it was dead. No static hissing this time, just nothing at all.
What's this?
Give me a second, Arnold said. After a reset, all the system modules have to be brought online manually.
Quickly, he went back to work.
Why manually?
Gennaro said. Will you just let me work, for Christ's sake?
Wu said, the system is not intended to ever shut down, so if it does shut down, it assumes that there is a problem somewhere. It requires you to start up everything manually. Otherwise, if there were a short somewhere, the system would start up, short out, start up again, short out again, in an endless cycle.
Okay, Arnold said, we're going. Gennaro picked up the phone and started to dial when he suddenly stopped.
Jesus, look at that, he said.
He pointed to one of the video monitors, but Arnold wasn't listening. He was staring at the map, where a tight cluster of dots by the lagoon had started to move in a coordinated way, moving fast, in a kind of swirl.
What's happening?
Gennaro said.
The duckbills, Arnold said tonelessly. They've stampeded.
The duckbills charged with surprising speed, their enormous bodies in a tight cluster, honking and roaring, the infants squealing and trying to stay out from underfoot. The herd raised a great cloud of yellow dust. Grant couldn't see the tyrannosaur. The duckbills were running right toward them. Still carrying Lex, he ran, with Tim, toward a rocky outcrop with a stand of big conifers. They ran hard, feeling the ground shake beneath their feet. The sound of the approaching herd was deafening, like the sound of jets at an airport. It filled the air and hurt their ears. Lex was shouting something, but he couldn't hear what she was saying, and as they scrambled onto the rocks, the herd closed in around them. Grant saw the immense legs of the first hadrosaurs that charged past, each animal weighing 5 tons, and then they were enveloped in a cloud so dense he could see nothing at all. He had the impression of huge bodies, giant limbs, bellowing cries of pain as the animals wheeled and circled. One duckbill struck a boulder, and it rolled past them, out into the field beyond. In the dense cloud of dust, they could see almost nothing beyond the rocks. They clung to the boulders, listening to the screams and honks, the menacing roar of the tyrannosaur. Lex dug her fingers into Grant's shoulder. Another hadrosaur slammed its big tail against the rocks, leaving a splash of hot blood. Grant waited until the sounds of the fighting had moved off to the left, and then he pushed the kids to start climbing the largest tree. They climbed swiftly, feeling for the branches as the animals stampeded all around them in the dust. They went up 20 feet, and then Lex clutched at Grant and refused to go farther. Tim was tired, too, and Grant thought they were high enough. Through the dust, they could see the broad backs of the animals below as they wheeled and honked. Grant propped himself against the coarse bark of the trunk, coughed in the dust, closed his eyes, and waited. Arnold adjusted the camera as the herd moved away. The dust slowly cleared. He saw that the hadrosaurs had scattered, and the tyrannosaur had stopped running, which could only mean it had made a kill. The tyrannosaur was now near the lagoon.
Arnold looked at the video monitor and said, "Better get Muldoon to go out there and see how bad it is." "I'll get him," Gennaro said, and left the room. The park. A faint crackling sound, like a fire in a fireplace. Something warm and wet.